Romans 8. Promised you we'd jump right in instead of, I think we've done 2 weeks on philosophical presupposition, and you guys all pretty much have that in your heads, I'm sure, by now. Verse 6 says, To be carnally minded, fleshly minded, is death. To be spiritually minded is life and peace. Verse 7, because the carnal mind is enmity against God, for it is not subject to the law of God, neither indeed can it be. And we've talked a couple weeks about that enmity, the againstness, the pushing against your fleshly mind and God's laws and God's intentions. And indeed it cannot please God. Verse 8, so then they that live by the flesh cannot please God. Verse 9 is where we picked up last week. But ye are not in the flesh, but in the Spirit, if so be that the Spirit of God dwells in you. Now if any man does not have the Spirit of Christ in him, he's none of Christ. We talked about the election implications of that. The main point I want you to get out of that, because we're building up to the therefore. There's a therefore in verse 12, which is where we left off last week, and I told you we would start with the word therefore. But if I sat down and said, therefore, that's kind of a concluding statement, so I thought I'd kind of like build up steam to get to it. You who are not in the flesh, but in the Spirit, you're that way if the Spirit of God is living in you. If you don't have the Spirit of Christ living in you, you're none of His. There is no other way to get to God. There is no other way to get to Christ. You either have the Spirit in you, which we all agreed last week only gets there by God's sovereign ordination to put it in you. The Spirit lists where it will. It's not up to you to decide where the wind goes or where the wind comes from. You can't tell where it goes or comes from. That's Jesus talking to Nicodemus, and yet he said, in order for a man to see God, he's got to be born again. But it's not up to you to get yourself born again. It's something that God does for you. Verse 10, and if Christ is in you, the body is dead because of sin, but the Spirit is life because of righteousness. And that's the extension of his theology earlier, where he said, if you were in Christ when Christ died, your fleshly body died with it. So your body has no more rights. The body of flesh is dead. But the Spirit that's inside you is life because of the righteousness of Christ. But if the Spirit of him that raised up Jesus from the dead, that's the Spirit of God that resurrected Christ, if that very same Spirit is dwelling in you, then he that raised up Christ from the dead shall also quicken your mortal body by his Spirit that dwells in you. And that's a fairly amazing statement to me, because it says that the very same Spirit of God that 2,000 years ago brought Jesus up out of the grave is the exact same Spirit living today in Mark. The one and the same Spirit with whom there is no time, with whom there is no expansive eons. The same Spirit that came down and quickened Christ, quickened Marcos, quickened Karen, quickened Jen. It's the same Spirit. It's the same God. That's an astounding statement, because the great miracle of Christianity is that Christ raised from the dead. That's the one unique feature of Christianity over all other religions, is that we say not only that God became man, but then that he died and got up again. That's the dividing line of all Christianity. If you don't believe Christ got up again, according to Paul, your faith is vain. If you say you've got faith only in this world, then we're of all men most miserable. But we say, according to Paul, that Christ resurrected, came up out of the grave. And the only reason you can believe that, because your flesh can't believe it, your fleshly mind can't comprehend that. Nobody ever by their own flesh figured God out enough to say, okay, I buy into that. The only reason you believe that Christ came up out of the grave 2,000 years ago is because the same Spirit that did it is in you telling you about it. Got that? Can you grab a hold of that? We're talking about a great big concept here. The same Spirit of God that brought Jesus up out of the grave one day landed in Brent and said, now let me tell you about what I did. And suddenly Brent is convicted in his heart and in his mind and in his soul of the truth of the fact that Christ came up out of the grave. How did he come to that conclusion? Brent's not that smart. How did Brent figure out that God raised Christ from the dead 2,000 years ago? He wasn't there. He wasn't a witness to it. He didn't see it happen. He didn't walk and talk with the risen Lord. How in the world did he come to that conviction? Well, the Spirit of Christ that raised, the Spirit of God that raised Christ is raising Brent and is beginning now. First, it's quickening his mind, quickening his heart, bringing him to God. When Brent dies, if in fact Brent dies, if the Lord tarries, Brent's own physical body will one day come up out of the grave. And the same Spirit that quickened Christ and brought him from death to life will bring Brent from death to life. The same epochal event that defines Christianity will happen individually in every single Christian. You get that? Christianity exists because Christ was dead and was physically in his body alive again. And one day, Jen, who is dead, will one day become alive again. She will experience the same quickening, the same dunamis of God, the power that quickened Christ will quicken her, but it's already begun. One day it'll raise up her physical body. It's already raising her up spiritually. It's already quickening her heart, quickening her mind, drawing her to God. That's the power that's bigger than Jen overwhelming her and doing for her what she couldn't do for herself, nor would do for herself, nor cared about. And then one day God came along and tapped her on the shoulder and said, "Hi, I'm God, and you're mine." And then began teaching her, predestined to be conformed to the image of his son. Got all that? They're like huge theological concepts. But if you can get a hold of those kind of notions, you'll see that Christianity is, as I've often said, more than just claiming a Cadillac. Christianity is more than just, what can God do for me down here, the great eternal bellhop. Please, God, give me more stuff. He is here to give you the life he gave Christ. But, oh, there's a reward attached. That's where Paul's going with all this. Trying to get you into the mindset that Paul's been developing. Because by the time he gets to verse 12, he then says, therefore, having said all that, having said everything I just said, building up through his letter, through 8 chapters now, he comes to this great therefore. And he's going to get theological on us. Therefore, brethren, we are debtors not to the flesh to live after the flesh. For if you live after the flesh, you will die. But if you through the Spirit do mortify the deeds of the body, you shall live. Now that sounds like legalism, doesn't it? You take that one out of context and just tell people, says right here, Paul says right here, that you have to mortify the deeds of your body and that's the way you live. That's why he couldn't say that until he had already expounded all the theology that said it is Christ in you, it is the Spirit in you, it is God in you that is driving you to do all these things. But if, in fact, the Spirit of God is in you, you will mortify the deeds of the flesh because you're no longer in debt to your flesh. Because the fact is, as I've pounded for several weeks, the fact is you're going to serve somebody. You're going to serve somebody. You're going to serve sin or you're going to serve God. And Paul does not leave any room, as we've seen now over and over again. He doesn't leave any gray area in the middle where you get to just like hang around and choose your master. Or say, I'm completely neutral, or I'm just spiritually good, or I'm any of that other. Libby likes to irritate me, by the way, by bringing home, I'll tell you what she did this week. She brought home a whole bunch of magazines from Ingram that were all these kind of new agey, quasi-spiritual, Enlightenment magazine was one of them. The God Within Us All. That once you come to find your Messiah, he has to die. Your Messiah has to die so that you can go on and become more than your Messiah. This kind of language. Yeah. And so she brought me home stuff like that so that I could read it and become increasingly irritated. Blasphemy Monthly. Yeah, that was one of them she brought home. And so, you know, I like read through them and get through them and then throw them in the garbage in anger and then I'm upset that I read them. Except that it shows me what the world out there thinks. The world out there that doesn't understand that they are serving sin and serving their flesh are so self-serving and so flesh-serving that they have created a theology around their flesh. And the theology of their flesh says there's such good in me, such a God in me, that if I just edify myself, I will eventually become the God that is within me. That's the language that they use over and over again. Become everything you're meant to be. Become everything that is the God within you. You're one with the rock and the tree and the Mother Earth and the sky and the birds and if you can just expand your mind to the point where you realize the God within you, then you will become everything you're meant to be. That kind of language. Well, you know what? Even as spiritual as that sounds, it struck me as I was reading these magazines one afternoon. There was like 4 or 5 of them, so I just plowed through them all. And suddenly it occurred to me how phenomenally egocentric these magazines were because of how completely flesh-serving they were. They were not ever going to bow to a God that said, serve me. Instead, every concept of God they had in these magazines was the God that served you. Because you're the center of your universe, and everything else revolves around you, and if there is in fact a God, it is a God concept that you create so that you can have a more fulfilled life. It is completely fleshly, egocentrically based. And even more astounding was the more I read it, the more I realized that that is exactly the kind of mystical spiritualism that is invading Christianity now. The kind of God they're talking about these days on TBN is the kind of God who serves you because of your spiritual power. They talk about your spiritual ability and your spiritual power. Write a message to the devil on the bottom of your shoe and then step on him. Like, you have the ability. You have the spiritual one-upmanship. You have the spiritual prowess that you can go around telling spiritual entities what to do and where to go. You command angels. You're the one who tells God, the great bellhop, what it is you want, and then he's obligated to do it for you. It's the same theology. It's that same you are the center of your spiritual universe kind of theology. Instead of realizing that Christ is the center of the spiritual universe and your position is to serve him. But in order to do that, you have to die. And that's not language that our flesh likes. Our flesh likes that language that says, no, I live because I'm everything. God saves me because I did something for him. I'm so spiritual. I talk in tongues. I dance around. I bark like a dog. My fillings turn gold. I'm so far up there on the spiritual plane that God can't help but save me because I'm so hyper spiritual. It's the same thing. It's the same stuff. But the Bible says, if in fact the Spirit of God, which is a very spiritual thing, is inside you, it will do just the opposite to you. It will kill your flesh. You will no longer be a debtor to your flesh. Your flesh will have no claim on you anymore to say, this is how we're going to live. Come on. You'll be able to turn your flesh down and say, no, there's a power in me now bigger than my sin desire. There is a power in me now that is such that I am not under debt to my flesh anymore to live and do the way my flesh would want it to live and do. Because therefore, brethren, we are no longer debtors to the flesh to live after the flesh. We talked about freedom a couple weeks ago. Genuine freedom is not just freedom from condemnation. That's the way most Christianity is preaching the freedom of Christ right now. Is that, yes, you're a sinner, and yes, you sin, but you're free from the condemnation that comes from that sin. God will never condemn you for your sin because Christ died for your sin. But then they stop there. Paul didn't stop there. And it drives me crazy that Paul didn't stop there. Because if he had, I would have liked that theology that says, it doesn't matter what you do because it's all under the blood and Christ paid for it anyway, so do what you want, it's okay. You know, no more debt, you have no more guilt, you're free to do whatever you want, you're guilt-free, Christ paid it all to him I owe. Sin has left a crimson stain, he washed it white as snow. Let's just stop there, that's good. It's too easy. Paul goes on and says, your freedom is so complete that you also have the freedom to resist the temptations of the flesh. Oh, well, see, now he's putting obligation on me. Now he's saying, live like a Christian too. You're bought with a price, act like it. Didn't want to have to act like it. I mean, just, you know, no condemnation. That's wonderful. That's great. Except that Paul goes on and extrapolates, not only is there no condemnation, but there is now death for your flesh because your flesh died with Christ. And you then are no longer in debt to your flesh. Instead, you're in debt to God. He bought you. You're indebted. He paid for you. He took away your guilt and promised you an eternity with him. You are thereby indebted to react to him. Now, then the great part is he doesn't leave you alone to work that out in your flesh. Because if Mike was left to his flesh, Mike and his flesh would never respond to God or do the right thing by God. So he puts that spirit inside Mike that raised Christ from the dead, which quickens Mike and drives Mike to do those things that would please the Father. So you still don't get any credit, but you're still going to move that direction, always pressing toward the mark. And I'll tell you right now, Because I know me, so I know you, because we share the same flesh. I know what I'm saying right now irritates you guys. Because there's a part of you saying, as I speak, your flesh is back there going, oh, is he really saying that we're not supposed to sin? Is that really what he's getting at? And you're arguing theologically in your mind, gosh, that sounds awfully legalistic, Jim. I thought we were supposed to be about grace. You know? Your flesh is going to start arguing. Oh, I can't live that way. I don't want to live that. Wait a minute. Are you saying I'm supposed? But I can't do it. I'm not even going to try. I can't do it. I can't live above the flesh. I just can't do it. That's the way I am. Are you being condemned? You're not condemning me, are you? You do. I know how it works. Because I'm doing it to myself while I read this. I'm reading Paul and saying, I don't like that theology, Paul. I don't like the theology that says, do better. That's what Paul says. Do better. Be the Christian. Bear fruit. Be so much different that it's obvious to people. I used to try very hard to not be obvious. I didn't want people to know I was a Christian. It still bothers me sometimes because when they know I'm a Christian, they think TBN, you know, and I have to go, no, not that. You know, I'm not, no siree, Bob. I'm not any of that stuff. Therefore, brethren, we are debtors not to the flesh to live after the flesh. Why? Because the flesh is dead. The flesh died when Christ died. If you live after the flesh, you'll die. That's why you're not in debt to the flesh. You've been freed from the flesh that would kill you. That's obvious enough, right? If God ever took his hand off you, Karen, would you go hog wild and kill yourself? Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Because the flesh will kill you. The good news is Christ killed the flesh. You were in him when he died. The proof is he's in you while you live. That's the equation. Something?
When you say free, it sounds like, oh, I can just not do it anymore, but it's not, it's like really hard.
Sure it's hard. Isn't that what all that arguing about, I know that the law is spiritual, I am carnal, sold unto sin, that which I do I allow not, that which I would not do, that's what I do. I mean, that's Paul saying, yeah, the fight is on, the fight is on. So what he's letting you know is that it's not you doing it. That the power of God, the Spirit of God inside you is quickening you, raising you up, changing you. Now, he's going to go on, because hold on, he's going to get to what you just said and say, now, by the way, we're never going to be completely redeemed until the resurrection. You're never going to be completely sinless until this physical body is finally laid down and raised up again. When your mortal body has been finally quickened once and for all, and you put on a body like Christ, then finally you'll be completely free from sin and able to live completely free from it. But the point is, the Spirit that will do that is in you already driving you toward that point. And if it isn't, if you're not in the process of being driven, then the Spirit's not in you. And if the Spirit's not in you, you're none of Christ. You get that whole equation? Now, I can break it down again to brass tacks. Are you different now than you were a year ago? 2 years ago? 3 years ago? What's the change? Well, the change is the Spirit inside you driving you, because left to yourself, you would degenerate. You would not regenerate. You would not get better where you left to yourself. You would get worse. But you're getting better. Why are you getting better? Well, because the Spirit that will one day make you perfect is already driving you toward that, which is great news. That's the proof positive that you are, in fact, Christ. The good news is to know that you are not saved by your ability to continue in some perfectionistic mode. The good news is the Spirit that's in you continues to be the Spirit of life even though you sin. That's what this whole conflict was about over here in chapter 7. Again, you're being saved not by your ability to hold on to Christ, but by his ability to save you, hold on to you. All right, let's keep going. Therefore, brethren, we are debtors not to the flesh to live after the flesh, for if you live after the flesh, you will die. But if ye through the Spirit do mortify the deeds of the body, you shall live. What does mortify mean? Put to death, kill. What is a mortician? Has to do with death. Mortify, kill, put to death. If, I can't say it more plainly than this. If you through the Spirit that's in you, do put to death the deeds of your body, you will live. Is that plain enough? I don't care how legalistic that sounds. I don't care how responsibility prone that sounds. The fact of the matter is, I preach grace as forthrightly as I possibly can, but I can't escape the fact that everything I know about grace I learned from Paul, and that Paul said, you need to mortify the deeds of your body. Kill the deeds of your flesh, because they're out to kill you. And you won't be able to do that except by the Spirit that lives inside you. And if by the Spirit inside you, you do kill the deeds of your flesh, you'll live. For as many as are led by the Spirit of God, these are the sons of God. Doesn't mean not women. Doesn't mean not daughters. It means these are the offspring of God. As many as are led by the Spirit of God, these are the children of God. So you're going to be led by one of two things. You're going to be led by your flesh. You're going to be led by your carnal desire. Or you're going to be led by the Spirit of God. You know, because you know, you know, you know, because I know. So you know when you're doing something wrong. You're doing it wrong, and you know you're doing it wrong, and you're doing it wrong anyway, and you know you're doing it wrong. Because the Spirit of God inside you is saying, hello, that would be wrong. And you're going, yeah, I know, shh. Yeah, I know, I know, I know, I know. But I have a good excuse. I'll quit next time. Just one more. It's not that late yet. It's not, we've all got an excuse. But he says here, in fact, if you are the offspring of God, that Spirit inside you will win eventually. It's going to lead you. It's going to take over. The conflict will rage, but the God inside you is bigger than the body, because the Spirit that's inside you is ever living. The body you're fighting with is dying. And the more powerful living Spirit is going to get you. And he can make it really uncomfortable. And he can make it really painful. And eventually you'll learn to just do it his way. And then life gets much easier. For as many as are led by the Spirit of God, these are the children of God. For you have not received the spirit of bondage again to fear. He's talking about what kind of spirit it is that you've received. You have not received the spirit of bondage, which would again lead to fear, but you have received the spirit of adoption, brought into the family, children, offspring of God. No longer are you just the creature. God is not just the great power in the sky that made the universe, spun it into existence, and then sat back and watched. He's the active participant who is so involved in your life that he lets you call him Dad. We receive the spirit of adoption whereby we cry, Abba, Father. Now, this was a contrast he had just built against what had happened to the children of Israel. The first time the children of Israel came in contact with the Spirit of God was at Mount Sinai. And as they all stood down at the foot of Mount Sinai, there was black clouds and thundering and lightning, and they all trembled and ran and hid for fear. And they went to Moses and said, look, you go talk to him. You tell us what he said. But we don't want to hear that voice anymore, because that's a scary voice. So then Moses goes up on the mountain, and God gives him the first few rules. He comes back down and says, here's the deal. I'm going to be up there talking to him for a while. I'm going to rope off the bottom of the mountain. Don't come near the bottom of the mountain, because the glory of God is going to descend on the mountain and it's going to become a holy mountain. And if so much as a dog walks to the foot of this mountain, you thrust him through with a dart. You kill any animal that gets near the foot of this mountain, because holy God is here. And you cannot approach holy God, or holy God will kill you. Got that? That was their first experience with the Spirit of God. And what did that Spirit of God put on them? Bondage. The first time they encountered the Spirit of God, it was a spirit of bondage. It came and said, here's the rules. Here are the rules. Live by them, die by them. There was no redemption in those rules. The rules couldn't bend and come down and say, oh, that's okay, you broke a rule, but I understand. All the law could do was condemn you and kill you. We've seen plenty of that in Romans so far. That was why he took all that time to say, all the law could do was kill. The letter of the law could only condemn. You needed to have somebody come and save you from that law, because the law was going to destroy you. That was the spirit of bondage, to fear. And he said, but this time through Christ, the Spirit that raised up Christ from the dead, that lives in you now, is not the spirit of bondage again to fear. That's not the spirit you got. You didn't get that Sinaitic legalistic spirit. Instead, the Spirit of God that raised up Christ on your behalf drives you to the adoption. You are now children. You're in the family. You're no longer an outsider that God is sitting as the judge. You're now part of the family. There is the Son of God, the one Son of God. The one Son of God inherits everything. And then you get adopted into the family. And you become joint heir with Christ, he's about to say. Now think about that for a moment. What does God own? Yeah, like all of it and all the stuff we don't even know about. All the stuff we can't conceive of. All of what makes up the universe. I mean, we're so silly, we think, you know, precious things down here are, you know, rocks that glitter. Who forwarded me the joke this week about a guy who was determined to take it with him? So before he died, he cashed in everything he had and sold his home and cashed in all his money for gold. And then managed by force of will to die and took his gold with him. And he got up to heaven and St. Peter meets him and he says, "What do you got in the bag?" And he opens it and says, "Look!" And Peter goes, "Oh, pavement." So, I mean, you know, we've got it all upside down and backwards. Streets of gold up there, pearly gates, you know, what do they care up there? Things we hold precious, they use as furniture. So, God who owns everything has promised to his son that he would inherit everything. Why? Because he's the rightful heir, because he's the son. And then God adopted Marcos. And because he's in the family, he now gets to go to God, the big scary condemnatory God, the big judging God. He gets to go walk up to him and call him Daddy, which is what Abba means. Abba is a very tender Hebrew word. The spirit of adoption is that spirit that is in you, is what Paul is saying. The very same spirit that raised Christ up from the dead because he's the Son. He raised him up because he was God's Son. And then he raises you up because you are God's sons and daughters. Raises you up because you are his children. You do belong to Christ. You are God's. So the spirit of adoption is in you. And when you go to talk to God, instead of being afraid of all the quaking and the clouds and the lightning and the stuff, instead you go to him and you say, "Dad, we got to talk." Now Jesus, when he was talking to his apostles, said, "You earthly fathers know enough if your child says, 'I'm hungry,' that you don't hand him a serpent. You know enough if he wants bread, you don't give him a stone. And if you, being evil," a phrase I love, Jesus throws that in, "and if you, being evil, know enough to give your children good things, how much more God in heaven, who is completely good, knows how to give good things to his children." So really, what are you worried about? Your Father in heaven, who invites you to call him Daddy, who said, "Seek first the kingdom of God and his righteousness, and all these things will be added to you." Go ask him for good things. He knows what you need. He knows what things you have need of before you ever ask. And then Jesus says, "Now go ask. Because he'll give you the good things. He'll take care of you." I say all the time, I'm 44 and I've never missed a meal. Never slept on the street. Always had at least one car in the driveway. I mean, I have more than I can use. We have closets stuffed full of stuff we don't even know. We have boxes full of things we haven't seen. Look around the house. We have so many accoutrements. I don't have to watch my TV in stereo. I don't have to have a TV. The amount of stuff that I have, we have food in the fridge that will go bad because we won't get to it. That's how much food we have. We have so many good things. It's because our Abba Father has taken care of us. So we go and we talk and we ask and we plead, and then one day it gets a little thin, and one day we hurt a little bit, and we run back and go, "What's wrong? Don't you love me anymore? I thought you liked me." Well, that's because, as Paul's going to tell us, he's putting hope into us. Let's go on. You have not received the spirit of bondage again to fear, but you have received the spirit of adoption, whereby we cry, Abba, Father. The Spirit itself, that Spirit that raised up Christ from the dead that lives within us, the Spirit itself bears witness with our spirit, small s, the person that is you, the person that is Mark. Mark one day is going to die. Mark's going to lay down in a grave somewhere if the Lord tarries. But Mark won't stop being. The entity, the personality that is Mark will live on. That's the small s spirit here. The personality that is Mark, that's living in this tent of human flesh, will outlive his flesh, should his flesh die before Christ comes back. And he said, the Spirit of God comes and testifies to the spirit that is Mark, that he is a child of God. You get that internal witness. You get that internal recognition of who you are. How does Mark know that he's God's own child? Because the Spirit of God that raised Christ from the dead lives in Mark and reassures him. The Spirit itself bears witness with our spirit that we are the children of God. And if we are children, we are also heirs. Christ is the heir of everything, but we as children are heirs of God and joint heirs with Christ. We share in Christ's inheritance, and he inherits everything. Let's talk about what Karen deserves. Karen probably deserves nothing, right? Karen, after the deeds of her flesh and the life that she is and the person that she is and the thoughts that she has, if we could get out the big screen and take a look at Karen's life and say, okay, what does Karen deserve? Karen probably deserves condemnation at best. Yeah? Am I lying on you yet? Yeah. Especially just for the earlier comment about not missing anything. That alone is enough to... So what does Karen get? She joins in the inheritance that Christ alone deserves. Well, then who cares about the Cadillac? If I die without ever having had $1 million, big deal. Because even the $1 million I may make in this lifetime, I can't take with me. All I need in this lifetime is enough to get me from here to dead. Right? I only need enough to get me from here to wherever the end of my life is. And when I reach that point, I'm going to fall asleep, broken sick, and wake up well and rich. Because I wake up as part of the inheritance of Christ. And he gets everything. And that's the inheritance that Christ said is incorruptible. He said, why do you lay up treasures where moth and rust come in and corrupt? It doesn't matter what kind of cloth you have. You don't have nice clothes. Moths can eat that up. You have nice precious metals. Rust can come and chew it up. Why do you lay up treasures on earth? He said, where the thief can come and steal. Big deal. It was yours today. It's somebody else's tomorrow. So what? He says, instead, lay up treasures in heaven where neither the moth or the rust or the thief can get to it. Everlasting treasures that are yours. Unfortunately, it's a perspective the Christian church doesn't have much these days. They've reduced Christianity to what Christ can do for you here and now. I deserve to be healed now and make a lot of money now and get a bigger car now, now, now. Well, I'm 44. If I make it to 70, I got 26 years left. And even if he poured out every earthly blessing there was, and like Bill Gates died tomorrow and surprise, I'm in his will, I've only got 26 crummy years to max out the billions of dollars and do whatever I can do with them, and then I die. And just like Bill, I got to leave all that to somebody else. And then I get to heaven and find out I don't get to come in and I lose out on the eternal inheritance of forever. I don't get that. I can't weigh that out. I would much rather make it through this lifetime by hook or crook, whatever it takes, and then get the eternal inheritance and join in the everything. The Spirit itself bears witness with our spirit that we are the children of God, and if we are children, then we're heirs. We are heirs of God. We are joint heirs with Christ. If so be, oh man, I hate it when he does this. I was clipping along happy as could be, and then he stuck an if in there. If so be that we suffer with him, that we may also be glorified with him. How was Christ glorified? He suffered. Why did he suffer? Because he submitted his will to the Father's will. He was in Gethsemane praying, and believe me, none of you have ever prayed like this. He prayed till he sweat blood. You haven't prayed that way yet. That's why the book of Hebrews has said, you have not yet resisted unto blood, striving against sin. You have not yet reached the point where you were so against sin that you were ready to sweat blood over it. Christ was. And prayed, Father, if it were possible, take this cup away from me. Because he knew he did not want to go through it. And then he said, but not my will, yours be done. And he submitted his flesh to the will of the Father. And he suffered so that 3 days later, he'd be glorified. Want to be part of all that good stuff we talked about? Okay, do exactly what Christ did. Submit your flesh to the will of the Father. Deny yourself, deny your flesh, deny your sinful desires, and submit your will to the will of the Father the same way Christ did. And that's tough, because our flesh wants what it wants when it wants it, and it always wants it now. So submit your will to the Father. Suffer with Christ, be glorified with Christ. Now, I don't want to ignore the historic context of Paul's admonition there to the Romans, too, when he said, if your children, your heirs, heirs of God, and joint heirs with Christ, if so be that we suffer with him, that we may also be glorified together. Remember that at that point in Rome, there was also great persecution against the Christians. So in the historic context, Paul is also telling them here, look, the suffering that you're going through right now, this suffering that you're putting up with as you submit yourself to God, he said, Christ suffered more than you. So if you suffer your body to be burned, or if you suffer to be eaten by lions, or if you suffer through these things, look forward to the glorification that comes with it. That's why he can say then in verse 18, for I reckon, good southern word there, for I reckon that the suffering of this present time, the sufferings of this present time, are not worthy to be compared to the glory which will be revealed in us. So he said, we will be glorified with Christ, joint heirs, glorified with Christ, if we suffer with him. He suffered, will suffer. And he said then, but this suffering that we're going to go through, that's nothing compared to the glory you're going to get. And unless you can keep that perspective, the suffering of this life will eat you up. And there's plenty of suffering to be had, whether or not you're burned at a stake or fed to lions. Sometimes life on earth can become really, really difficult, whether that's through sickness, whether it's through poverty, whether it's through just looking around at the world. That's the biggest thing I suffer from. I look at the world and I'm just tired of it and terrified by it and wish I could just be done with it and get off it. I can't wait for Christ to come back and mop up the floor with some of these people. But there's suffering to be had. There's time to be spent. There's fleshly, earthly things to go through. And he reminds us, look, Christ suffered more, but the suffering you're going through, nothing compared to the glory that's coming. And how far, again, thinking about it, you're God. You have all control of all things. You're God. You can create whatever you want to create. If you want to create glory around yourself, I mean, God did it. He came to Job and said, go ahead, array yourself in light and glory. I did it. Go ahead. If you want to be me, you know, knock yourself out. God arrayed himself in splendor and then made angels to fly around his head singing glory to him, singing holy, 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 and he made creatures to serve him, and he created an entire universe around himself to glorify himself. So how much glorification is God capable of conceiving of? And then he said, now all glory is going to go to my Son, so he's going to absolutely glorify the Son, and then he says, now you get to share in that glory. What kind of glory is God capable of creating for Marcos? Well, then this suffering doesn't seem like that big a deal, does it? You know, get me through my 70 years. Get me through whatever it takes to get me from here to dead. And then wake me up in the place where the God who is my dad, who knows how to give me all good things, desires to glorify me. Those are the kind of treasures and the kind of riches eternal that I really want. I reckon that the suffering of this present time, they are not worthy to be compared with the glory that shall be revealed in us. Now, verse 19. There are several words I stuck up here because this verse is so deeply theological that as I read it, I thought there's no way to explain it without putting all these words in front of you. So we're going to look at some of these Greek words and pull this apart and put it back together because the rest of this chapter is kind of built off of the concepts of this verse. He says, the earnest expectation of the creature waits for the manifestation of the sons of God. Now, in simplest terms, what that means is the creature, that would be Bruce, that would be Mike, us, the creatures, our earnest expectation, the thing we look forward to most, is when we will be manifested as the risen sons of God. When we're finally, when the adoption is complete, when we're yanked up out of the grave and given our glorified bodies, when God finally glorifies us the way he intends to glorify us, when that glory that we're looking forward to finally takes place, he said, the creature, us, the created ones, our earnest expectation is that moment. Well, yeah. But it's even deeper than that. The two words, earnest expectation, are a translation of the Greek word apokaradapia. Apo is the word from, kara is your head, dokeo means to expect, the picture word, means to push your head forward in expectation. It's like the guy at the end of the race who's cutting across the wire at the same time as another guy, and in order to win the race, juts his head out forward, so he's the first one across the finish line. That's the way he said the creature expects. Constantly pushing your head forward. Look, just come on. He said that's the earnest expectation of the creature. Once the Spirit of God is inside the creature, the Spirit of God drives him to push his face forward toward God in earnest expectation. Isn't that a great picture? Then he says that face forward, pressing earnest expectation of the creature waits for apek and dakomei. Apo as a preposition can also be used as an intensive, and that's the way it's being used here. In other words, I've told you how kata means the ultimate or supreme one, or a means to negate something. Apo can be used as an intensive. In other words, you take the word, then you stick apo on the front of it, and what it means is this word intensified. So ek dakomei, if I can pronounce that, means hope and patience. In other words, it's used, and this is really particular. Paul only uses that word when he's talking about the Christian hope and patience. The Christian who is earnestly expecting the return of Christ, the redemption of the body, the raising up, the resurrection. He only uses that word in that sense, and then he stuck apo on front of it. So he's saying we have this hope and this patience inside us that supersedes normal hope or normal patience. That a person after the flesh might be able to patiently endure, but the reason we patiently endure is because we do it to the extremity, because our face is forward, because we're waiting for the redemption. It's a whole other character that he's creating here. A character so confident because the Spirit of God is in him that he endures and he hopes. That's why Paul would say in another place, love, charity, endures all things, then it hopes all things. Same idea. That Christian hope and expectation is based on the fact that we have this earnest spiritual drive initiative inside us that can't wait for the redemption of our bodies. That's our hope. That's our expectation. That's why we get through what we get through. But the manifestation, oh, that's great. The manifestation of the sons of God is the word apokalypsis. If that's familiar to you, the word apokalypse comes from it, and it's the book of Revelation. If you were reading the book of Revelation in the Greek, you would be reading the Apocalypsis. Now, the Apocalypsis is one of three words that is ever used to talk about the coming of Christ. One is parousia. Are you familiar with that word? That simply means an appearance or a manifestation of Christ. There is also the epiphany of Christ. Christ, when he was born the first time, was in fact an epiphany. And what an epiphany is sort of a mysterious understanding. If you suddenly understand something you never understood before of a spiritual nature, you've had an epiphany, you've had an awakening. When the shepherds were out in the field at night, and the angel of the Lord came to the shepherds and said, "In the city of David is born unto you a Savior," that was an epiphany to them. Something they didn't know was given to them exclusively, and they were opened up spiritually. And they came to understand something spiritually they didn't understand before. But an epiphany is a very personal and a very private thing. Certain people understood what happened when Christ came the first time, but not everybody. A parousia is an appearance. When Christ comes in the rapture, there will be an appearance of Christ, but it'll only be seen by those people who have had the epiphany. The people who he comes to get in the rapture are those people who have the face forward, earnest expectation looking for him. To those who look for him, he shall appear the second time. That's Paul writing. The people who have that earnest hope, face forward, looking for him, have had the epiphany, the understanding, and they will see the parousia, which is the appearance of Christ. They'll see him in the clouds, they'll be gathered to him, and so shall we ever be with the Lord. But that is not an apocalypsis. Apocalypsis is revelation, which is why the book of Revelation is about Christ coming back in such a way that everybody sees him. And it is a wide open general revelation of Christ coming back in power and authority and judgment and anger, and every eye beholds him. That's very different. Paul grabbed that word apocalypsis to say this is the complete understanding, the complete revelation of Christ. The earnest expectation, the face forward looking forward to, of the creature, that's us, we wait for, we have the earnest hope and patience for the revelation, the full opening of the sons of God. You get how large that is? The Christian hope, the Christian desire, the Christian internal craving is the redemption of the body. And that is what we press our face toward. Then he tells us exactly what that is. Because the creature, that's us, the ones who have that expectation, the creature was made subject to vanity. We were made fleshly. We naturally, egocentrically want our fleshly things. Why? We were made that way not willingly, but we were made that way by the reason of him who have subjected those same people in hope. Now, this is Paul saying that everything that has happened thus far, the introduction of sin, the fall in the garden, none of this is a mistake. This is the big plan of God. God on purpose subjected human beings to fleshly vanity on purpose, according to his plan. Why? So that he could also subject them to this, the hope. No mistake here. The creature, you and I, were made subject to vanity, not willingly. We didn't choose vanity. We were made vanity. We were created in Adam's sin. We are created in this vanity, not willingly, but for the reason, but by reason of him who has subjected the creature in hope, because the creature itself also shall be delivered from the bondage of corruption into the glorious liberty of the children of God. Is that big enough, thick enough for you? God on purpose made Mark vain. Why? So that Mark would press his face out, longing and hoping for the redemption that would come one day to him. God on purpose subjected Mark to fleshly vanity so that Mark would also, through the Spirit of God that was in him, face forward crave his bodily redemption. Did you get all that? Why? Because that's faith. That's faith. God is creating faith in Mark. We are saved by grace through faith. Faith in God, faith in Christ. So how does he produce that faith in you? He subjected you to vanity, put his Spirit inside you, and then that Spirit drives you face forward to long for the redemption, to the adoption of the sons of God. And that faith is what is in the process of saving you. God knows what he's doing. It's a great big plan at work in your life. Now keep going, keep going, keep going. I can't stop here. We got to get somewhere. For we know, verse 22, for we know that the whole creation is groaning and travailing in pain together until now. The whole creation, when Adam sinned, for the first time there were thorns. For the first time there was storms. For the first time there were earthquakes. For the first time there was trouble in the world. For the first time there was sin in the universe. For the first time earth became the domain of the devil. For the first time the creation itself, not just you, but the whole of the world became engulfed in sinfulness. And so he said that whole creation groans for the redemption the same way you do. That the whole of nature and the whole of earth desires and wants to be redeemed. They are all waiting for the apocalypse. They are all waiting for the revelation of Christ to come so that all of God's creation can be redeemed. You getting the picture? But wait, there's more. It keeps building. But not only they, not only it, not only the creation itself, but we ourselves also that have the first fruit of the Spirit in us. The first fruit of the Spirit is the Spirit that raised Christ from the dead, making him the first fruits of the resurrection. He's the first fruit of the resurrection. The first fruit of the Spirit is in you. It's the same Spirit. We who have the first fruit of the Spirit, even we ourselves, groan within ourselves, waiting for, there's that word again, there's that word, the hope and the patience, the waiting for. We are waiting for the adoption. What is the adoption? To wit, the redemption of our body. Face forward, longing for the redemption of our body when we will finally be adopted to the sons of God, the thing we are predestined to finally be. That's what we're longing for and craving for by the Spirit that drives us. But wait, for we're saved by that very hope, the hope that he drove into us. He put us in sin, he put us in flesh, he put us in vanity on purpose to drive us to hope because we're being saved by hope. El peace, the basis of faith. Are you getting all this? Hope, is this all piecing together yet? Wait, I'm not done yet. I got to get somewhere. I'm trying to get to Romans 8:28. We are saved by hope, but hope that is not seen is not hope. That's why he put you in vanity. Because if you were already what you were going to be, you wouldn't hope for it. You'd already have it. So instead, he subjected you to vanity so that you'd have to hope. Because through hope, you have faith. Through faith, you're saved. For we are saved by hope, but that that is seen is not hope. For what man seeth, why is he yet hope for it? You're not going to hope for something you already see. If you were already in your glorified body, you wouldn't be hoping for the glorified body. Your face wouldn't be out. You wouldn't be pressing for it. You'd already have it. I don't hope for my car. I've got my car. It's out in the driveway. That's a done deal. I don't have the glorified body. Oh, I hope for it. I long for it. I'm being saved by that hope that's in me. That confident expectation of good things to come that is in me, driving me, and I'm being saved through that process. But if we hope for that which we don't see, then we with patience, there it is, wait for it. There it is, hope and patience, the Christian hope of adoption. We wait for it because we have the hope within us. See how he keeps using these words? He keeps turning these words around to show you that God knows what he's doing. Why are we sinners? Why are we living as sinners? Because God knew what he was doing. He put you in vanity on purpose so that he could drive you to hope. So he could drive you to faith and by faith save you. Likewise, the Spirit that lives inside you, large S, the Spirit also helps our infirmities because we don't know how we should pray for what we ought. We don't know how to pray as we ought, but the Spirit itself makes intercession for us with groanings which cannot be uttered. There are some things our flesh can't even say. There are some things our flesh, sinful flesh, doesn't know how to say to God. So we just press our face forward and hope. And then the Spirit groans inside us. The Spirit helps our infirmities because we don't know how to pray as we ought. But the Spirit itself makes intercession for us with groanings that can't even be uttered. Because he that searches the hearts, that's God, knows the mind of the Spirit, that's the Holy Spirit living inside you. Because he, the Spirit, makes intercession for the saints according to the will of God. Look, 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 look what's happening. Your sinful vanity, your sinful self, that was on purpose by God. He subjected you to vanity on purpose so that he could drive you to hope. The hope would drive you to faith, and even in faith, your sinful flesh doesn't know how to pray as it ought to. But the Spirit that he put inside you knows how to pray to God and does pray on your behalf and groans with utterances you can't even say and says things to God that are according to God's will to say the things that you ought to say, but you can't. Why? Because we know that all things work together for good to those who love God, who are the called according to his purpose. What are the all things now? In Paul's context, the all things that work together for good, people love to grab that phrase and say all things work together for good. Oh, it's a whole lot more than just the little things of your life. It's the all things that include the fact that God subjected you to vanity. It's the all things that include that the Spirit of God is inside you praying for things you can't say. It's the all things because God who searches the heart knows what the Spirit is saying on your behalf. It's the all things because the God who intended to save you and predestinated you before the foundation of the world created the methodology to save you through his Son and is doing it despite you. And all of those things that make up heaven, hell, or earth are working for Mike's good. Why? Because he was called according to God's purpose. You get that? See how big that is? Paul created this enormous theology to say that all things work together for Bruce's good. God knew what he was doing. Someday, Bruce is going to say, if he hasn't already, woe is me. You know what? That was for your good. One day, Bruce woke up and said, I think I believe in God. And you know what? That was for his good. Sometimes, Bruce feels so bad about himself and his sin and his flesh that he can't even find the words. And you know what? That was for his good. Sometimes the Spirit has to, on behalf of Bruce, who is too feeble to go and talk to God and know what to say, the Spirit talks for him, and the Spirit of God that raised up Christ goes and speaks to God on Bruce's behalf for his good. And then God gives Bruce credit for the conversation that he and the Spirit had because that was for Bruce's good. And the Spirit that is inside him drives Bruce to put his face out in earnest expectation, waiting for the adoption of the sons when one day his body will be redeemed and he'll be raised up out of the grave, the perfect and the new man. And that's what he absolutely craves because that's for his good. Because that craving, that desire, creates hope. And the hope produces faith. And it's all for his good. Why? Because he was called according to his purpose. Now, I told you last week that that verse in the Greek actually reads, we know that all things work together for good, for positive, to them that love God, to them who are the, according to purpose, called. In the English, it doesn't read right. So they said the called according to his purpose. But no, you're the according to purpose called. Definite article, the, means it's not everybody. And you weren't just called randomly, you were called according to purpose. According to God's purpose, he then called you and subjected you in hope. Why did he do all that? Because he predestinated you, but we'll get to that next week. Next week, we'll get into 29 and predestination. And then he's going to launch off into election, and then he's going to go into Israelology, and then Paul's getting real deep theological here. But do you understand what that section, that's why I had to get this whole section in one big chunk. We had to get all this, and then we had to see that the all things that work together for good is much, much more than just, I have a cold, this must be working for my good, or I drove through McDonald's and they were out of ketchup, that must be working for my good. Now, Paul's point is the largest theological concepts that God himself created are working for your good. That's the all things. God devised a plan that you are in that so far supersedes you that your hope, your faith, and even your ability to pray are all driven by the Spirit of God that is in you, that is the Spirit that raised Christ from the grave. So then how secure are you? That's where he's going to go next week. How secure are you? He foreknew you. He predestinated you. He foreordained you. And he will glorify you. And in fact, past tense, already did glorify you when Christ died. That's where he's going. So then, in fact, all things work together for good, don't they? All of that stuff, all the foreordination, all the predestination, all the Spirit that's inside you, and even the fact that you were subject to vanity, even the fact that you were made not willingly subject to vanity and your body was made fleshly and egocentric was for your good. It was made that way so that he could then subject you to hope and by hope save you. You're dealing with a great big God. You're dealing with an Abba Daddy that loved you so much that in his supreme wisdom, he has utterly and completely controlled the plan and the situation of your life so that you will ultimately end up glorified by him. And you're in that plan. You can't escape it. You're in it. He's got you. And so, in fact, all things work together for your good. And not your minor good, not your little good, not your, you know, oh, we went in and we tried to get a loan and it didn't go well and then something happened and then we got the loan because all things work together for my good. That's not the good he's talking about. I mean, yes, God will provide for you good things, and yes, yes, but the good he's talking about is your glorification, your ultimate glorification, the adoption of children, the redemption of your body. That's what he's talking about. That's the good. The glorification. That's the good I want. Keep the other stuff. Just give me that redeemed body thing. And everything is working toward that.